Hello, this is Wendy Bauer, reading to you today from the Decatur Herald and Review, October 16th, 2017. And we'll begin on the front page with an article by Ryan Voiles, Funding Still a Question, from Decatur. Process for $220 million Macon County Beltway may take years. While officials prepare to break ground next spring on the first piece of the Macon County Beltway project, its long-term success still hinges on an issue that's dogged the proposal from the beginning: how to pay for construction, now estimated at $220 million. The project has been in the works for decades and is envisioned as a dedicated roadway to loop truck traffic around the southern and eastern edges of Decatur, rather than trucks having to have rural streets and congested areas. Advocates have long touted the road as a key piece of Decatur's economic development. Now, they are looking to President Donald Trump's administration for help. "If we do not get federal funding, we cannot realistically start on this," said Macon County Highway Engineer Bruce Bird. "We're at a point in the process where we're trying to line up funding for it, and with all the uncertainty involved, it's likely going to be a process that will be ongoing for many years." City and county leaders currently are focused on the first segment of the Beltway, which would cost $140 million and create 6.2 miles of four-lane road between Illinois 48, near Interstate 72, and Illinois 105, or William Street Road. The road would closely follow Raised Bridge Road and Prairie View Road before connecting with Illinois 105 east of the Decatur Airport. A delegation of local elected officials and business leaders took their case to Washington, D.C. this summer to lobby for the Beltway and a proposed overpass on Brush College Road on the city's northeast side. Both projects are part of a broader expansion of the Midwest Inland Port, a network of private railroads, container loading facilities, and public highways in and around Decatur. Now officials will wait to see whether they receive any dollars through their grant applications to Infrastructure for Rebuilding America, the U.S. Department of Transportation program that assists in local road projects. No decision for federal dollars is expected to be known until next year at the earliest. Local and state funding sources also will be needed, Bird said, but federal dollars are what will push the project forward. The new standards for the $1.5 billion infra grant, including a heavy emphasis on private investment, which raises questions about how areas outside major population centers, like Decatur, would be able to leverage that kind of money when toll roads are not feasible. Trump has said he wants to invest $1 trillion in infrastructure, but has not specified how that process will work. The president in August also signed an executive order that seeks to speed up approvals for infrastructure projects. Private partners like the Norfolk Southern Corporation and Archer Daniels Midland control major assets in the Greater Midwest Inland Port project, and the roadwork cannot be done without land donations from ADM, Richland Community College, and the Decatur Park District. It also was announced last month that the county had reached a tentative agreement to purchase land near Brush College Road and Illinois 48 that would allow work to start on a connector project that itself would be the starting point for the Beltway. Work on the road is expected to start as early as next spring. The county will pay a total of $225,000 for the 8.3 acres of land they've spent the last 6 months negotiating to purchase with private landowners. The county will pay about $26,500 per acre, said County Board Chairman Jay Dunn, as well as the filing and legal fees to get the deal done. That amount would seem to point to how important local officials felt it was to move forward with the project, as so-called excellent farmland in the central Illinois area can go for, on average, $10,525 an acre, according to a 2017 report from the Illinois Society of Professional Farm Managers and Rural Appraisers. Byrd said the county's original offer of $17,000 an acre was based on an appraisal completed by Webster and Associates last fall. The original valuation included factors such as potential economic use of land, and Byrd said the rest came down to finding a dollar amount that the county and landowners could agree on. The county had originally sought the ability to use Quick Take eminent domain to acquire the land, which was granted to them this summer by state lawmakers. An agreement between the two parties will prevent that action from going forward. The land acquisition and cost to redevelop the intersection is covered by $10 million in state money given to the county in 2014 by former Governor Pat Quinn. Other behind-the-scenes projects are also likely to occur in the coming year, which includes the purchase of right-of-way and moving utilities, which Byrd said can be covered by whatever is left of the $10 million or other state funds. While it may seem an uphill climb, officials like Byrd are optimistic that all the studies and work done in the past decade, plus, have put them in a good position to acquire the funds necessary to make the Beltway a reality in the near future. We're in a very good spot with all of the work we've done, and that is the feedback we're getting from those who are reviewing our applications, he said. And I think that is part of the reason why we feel confident we can probably start to build something relatively soon. So we don't have anything yet, and we're not guaranteed to get anything. But as we look around, we're feeling really good. And also on the first page, Together Decatur column. Love God and love others. Faith and worship find home at Decatur House of Prayer. Donette Beckett writes, from Decatur, some friends of Jean Whiteside suggested she visit a building known for praying. Because they know I like to pray, she said. Before she went to the Decatur House of Prayer, Whiteside said she had emotionally built up walls to keep her distance from others. The people she met helped her meet others and find a peace. The fellowship has helped me accept people and see the gift of God in each person, she said. Although House of Prayer may sound like a church, it is designed for praying. The building is open noon to 8 p.m. Tuesdays and Thursdays at 1920 North Oakland Avenue. The people devote their time to prayer. No sermons, no lessons, no collection. They pray for anything, including sick, poor, society, family, education, government, economy, arts, and media. If you have a half-hour lunch, you can come in here and sit for a while, Liz Holmgren said. It is just a time for you to spend time with God, just you. The group is a non-denominational, Bible-based organization. In 2012, it became a 501c3, not-for-profit corporation. Kim Robinson organized the Decatur House of Prayer after attending a similar facility in Kansas City, Missouri. It is a place to go for meditation, rest, renewal, and refreshment without distractions, she said. The team will not know if someone from another faith joins them. We don't ask, said Heather Dyer. We're not a church. We don't have a minister. We don't have sermons, said attendee John Robinson. We have the Bible. We have worship time. People in the audience can meditate, relax, study, or pray. We call it soaking, Dyer said. Prayers are conducted through music led by teams. Musicians, singers, healers, and greeters are just a few of the positions that make up DHOP. Robinson has been part of the team since his wife formed DHOP in 2005. He said DHOP follows two biblical rules, to love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, he said, quoting the Bible. We do that with the music and scripture. The second rule they follow is to love others. That is the whole concept for this, Robinson said. The idea isn't to pray for just me. Kansas City's International House of Prayer began in 1999 with the same mission plan explored by those in Decatur 6 years later. When they started, there was just a trailer with very few people, Whiteside said. They just kept at it. The international organization is now a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week facility, allowing anyone who feels the need to pray to join them. That is the vision we have, Whiteside said, about DHOP. DHOP began at another location before it found its permanent home on Oakland Street. Lampstand and Guiding Light Ministry joined together for a similar community opportunity. That is just where it was housed, Dyer said. When there was space, we moved. They moved into their current location 2 months ago, continuing their focus of prayer. The only visible Christian feature is the crosses hanging on a wall, all donated by visitors of DHOP. So far, approximately 40 crosses, most no more than 12 inches in length, can be seen upon entering the building. They symbolize that we pray for all of the community, Holmgren said. We would like to fill the whole wall. During their opening hours, music and prayer is a constant presence. If the team is not performing the music, the International House of Prayer broadcast is televised there. Prayer rooms are available for the healing teams from 6:30 to 8 p.m. on Thursdays. Those who need individual prayer can use these rooms. We don't counsel, we're not doctors, Dyer said. We just join you in your prayers and support your needs, whether it is a physical, spiritual, or emotional need. Whiteside has found a place at DHOP as a greeter. She has witnessed people leaving visibly moved. But some people come in and sit a while, she said. People leave with hope they didn't have when they came in. In the sidebar notes, if you go, it's the Decatur House of Prayer, open noon to 4 p.m. Tuesdays and Thursdays, located at 1920 North Oakland Avenue, Decatur. You can find more information on the web at decaturhop.org. Next, Illinois late to its own birthday party. State's bicentennial features late start, modest budget. From Springfield, Illinois is on the brink of its bicentennial bash, but political skirmishing that has battered the state could be blamed for late party planning, a comparatively low budget, and ultimately its contribution to future generations. The plans to celebrate Illinois' December 3, 1818 admission to the Union seem to pale compared with the two states that joined just prior. Indiana and Mississippi spent tens of millions of dollars and have flashy legacy projects to show off. The Prairie State, just 7 weeks from kickoff of its year-long festivities, is aiming to raise a modest $4 million to $6 million. Stuart Lane, executive director of the Illinois Bicentennial, acknowledges planning got a belated start with his appointment just a year ago. While he said significant corporate and other donors are stepping up, he would not say how much has been raised. But he dismissed the idea that 2 years of infighting in the 21st state between Republican Governor Bruce Rauner, who appointed him, and Democrats, who control the General Assembly, over a budget that is billions in the red, has hamstrung the project. He said he's taken two things from virtually every conversation he's had about the Illinois celebration. People want us to use the bicentennial as a platform to change the conversation about the state of Illinois, to talk about all the great things that Illinois has contributed to society, Lane said in a speech in Springfield this month. The second is pride. People are proud to be from this state. That has become our mantra. There are plans for exhibits, a school curriculum, a United Center ceremony honoring 200 Illinoisans in arts, entertainment, sports, agriculture, and business, and more. But it's hard not to notice what's been done elsewhere. Raising $55 million by leasing unused state-owned cell tower space, Indiana, which celebrated its bicentennial last December, built a state archives building, a state house lawn bicentennial plaza, a state library learning center, and an inn at a state park. In Mississippi, years of planning went into the celebration, along with over $100 million, including $90 million from taxpayers, for construction of the Museum of Mississippi History and Mississippi Civil Rights Museum in downtown Jackson. Katie Blount, the bicentennial organizer and director of the Mississippi Department of Archives and History, said the museums will open December 9th, on the eve of Mississippi's birthday. It's nice to cut ribbons on grand projects to mark such events. Illinois did it when ground was broken for the $3 million Centennial Building, now the Michael J. Howlett Building on the state capitol grounds in 1918. But the key to Indiana's celebration was buy-in, said former U.S. Representative Lee Hamilton, a Democrat who chaired the state's bicentennial with then-Lieutenant Governor Becky Skillman, a Republican. We'd go to the civic groups, the Rotary, or Kiwanis with our bicentennial plans and say, "What are you going to do about it?" Hamilton said. We'd push and prod, and some would ignore you. Some would say, "You're wasting your time." But most reacted positively to it. It instilled some pride, and people started to say, "I'm glad I'm a Hoosier." Yes, Indiana's commission had a top-notch staff that traveled 65,000 miles and visited 300 communities, Hamilton said. But coordinators in all 92 counties directed how to celebrate in a locally appropriate way, he said. Lane, who's paid $142,000 through state tourism funds, said he has a small staff. In Mississippi, Blount agreed that people are key. The state-of-the-art museums cover the sweep of state history, and, in the civil rights section, the state's unique place, warts and all, in the struggle for racial equality. They will be the state's birthday gift to the future. But the bicentennial celebrations that took place in communities across the state had a real grassroots spirit and reflected lots of different people's ideas about what the bicentennial means to Mississippi, Blount said. And the funding came from many sources, in addition to the Mississippi legislature. Tony Reed writes from Decatur, "School staff member hurt in confrontation," from Decatur. A staff member of Stephen Decatur Middle School was battered Friday afternoon while attempting to restrain and calm a violent student, police said. Sergeant Josh Sheets said the 12-year-old male student had been kicking a door, throwing furniture around, and making threats. As the female staff member struggled to hold the student, she was kicked in the knee. Patrol officers said she had a noticeable limp when they arrived but refused medical attention. The boy was released into the care of his mother. He faces preliminary charges of aggravated battery and disorderly conduct. Preliminary charges are subject to review by the state's attorney. Maria Robertson, a spokeswoman for the Decatur School District, said no one was available to comment on the incident Sunday evening. From the local page, City Council to talk zoning. Today's meeting set to cover topics from taxes to public works director. Tom Lisi of the Herald and Review writes, "The Decatur City Council is scheduled to meet at 5:30 p.m. today in the chambers at the Civic Center, 1 Gary K. Anderson Plaza. Here are four things to watch for. New residential development. The council will be voting to approve zoning changes for a new residential development on East Fitzgerald Road, just east of the AMC Movie Theater off Illinois 121. City officials say it's the first major residential subdivision of its size in years. Roy Mosser, a Forsyth real estate developer, is asking the city to approve 31 residential lots for single-family homes. City Manager Tim Gleason called it a promising sign that private developers may be starting to get more bullish on the Decatur market. The homes would fall into the Mount Zion School District. Mosser did not return a request for comment. Gleason said staff had been aware of the development for years, but now the developer is moving to have the City Council rezone the area. Apparently, Mosser sees an opportunity, or the timing's better, and is now advancing this, Gleason said. Next, sales tax revenue down, video game dollars up. Cities all over the country are dealing with dipping sales tax revenue with the steady growth of online retailers gobbling up brick-and-mortar business. Decatur collects a portion of a state sales tax and its own city sales tax, both of which officials say are projected to dip this year. The city's sales tax could fall below $10 million, which would be $1 million less than 2012. The state budget enacted in July now requires local governments to give 2% of state sales tax receipts to the state of Illinois, which has helped state sales tax revenue for the city to fall by $200,000. The saving grace for the city budget has been the video gaming tax, which is on track to collect $400,000 more for the city than just 2 years ago. Currently, the city is home to 382 video gaming terminals, which has brought in about $100,000 a month to city coffers. Though the hotel tax looks strong this year, the city projects receipts from the food and beverage tax to be $250,000 less than last year, a worrisome sign for the local economy. Food and beverage tax receipts grew modestly over the last 3 years. Next, last chance to join neighborhood committees. Officials say over 70 residents have signed up for the Neighborhood Revitalization Project's Citizen Committee groups. Gleason said he's very happy with the interest so far and is looking to the first Tuesday of November for the first meeting. Officials say participants will be broken into groups and come up with ideas and solutions on certain topics relating to rehabbing Decatur's core neighborhoods. The deadline for signing up is Wednesday. And finally, Interim Public Works Director. In lieu of the retiring Public Works Director Rick Marley on Tuesday, Gleason said City Engineer Matt Newell will become Interim Public Works Director. Gleason said he's decided to freeze the candidate search for the position until the beginning of the year, when he said it's easier for families to relocate. Gleason said Newell is a candidate for the permanent position. And next from the local page, Tony Reed writes from Warrensburg, "Picking the perfect pumpkin. Optimal growing season leads to bountiful pumpkin patch." It was beginning to look a lot like Halloween Sunday out at windswept and chilly Black Bart's Pumpkin Patch near Warrensburg. But for those who got it into their gourds to go seek the glowing orange symbols of the season, however, it would take more than a spell of fall weather to hex their efforts. A case in point was 9-year-old Avery Puckett, manfully hauling a cart laden with 5 fat pumpkins. Avery had selected them with the help of his brother Emery Bergener, 6, and their mom, Tabitha Tester. The Decatur family likes to hit Black Barts because, as Tester put it, they're always friendly and have a good selection. One of the family pumpkins will be donated to Parsons School for class carving projects, and the rest will go under the knife Saturday, laid out for cosmetic surgery on a series of trash bags in the living room. Tester says the scary part about Halloween is the mess of sticky pumpkin guts that have a tendency to wind up everywhere. But the boys always like the end result when you put in that little candle and light it, she added, so it's worth it. The 2017 pumpkin season is lighting up as one of the best in recent memory, thanks to ideal growing conditions. Black Bart's manager and co-owner, Joel Johnner, said it had seen close to perfect weather, as if the very atmosphere was bewitched. Not too dry and not too wet, it's been a really good year, he explained. Black Bart's tries to flesh the pumpkins out with other attractions and distractions, including a tractor-pulled barrel train, new for this year, and old favorites like a haunted house safe enough for wee ones to venture inside. Couple all that with rows of gleaming already picked pumpkins, or loads more lying out in the fields, and Johnner said a visit made a nice event for the family. Come on out and spend the day, he said. But there is a lot more to this pumpkin phenomena than just jack-o'-lantern fodder, however. A recent CNBC story said pumpkin-related products, from cream cheese to yogurt and even dog food, now added up to spooky-level sales valued at $414 million a year. Sales of fresh pumpkins hit $121 million in 2016, up 5% from the year before. And sidebar notes, if you go, Black Bart's Pumpkin Patch is at 9381 West Wise Road in Warrensburg. It's open through October 29th. Call 217-672-8287 or go to www.blackbartspumpkinpatch.com. And from the meeting calendar, here's the week's schedule of government meetings and other activities of interest to the public in Decatur and Macon County. Today, the Argenta Village Board of Trustees meets at 6 p.m. in the Village Hall, 330 North Warren Street. The Barclay Public Library District Board of Trustees meets at 7 p.m., 220 East Main Street, Warrensburg. The Decatur City Council meets at 5:30 p.m. in the Council Chambers, 3rd floor, Decatur Civic Center, 1 Gary K. Anderson Plaza. The Forsyth Village Board of Trustees meets at 6:30 p.m. in the Village Hall, 301 U.S. 51. The Hickory Point Town Board of Trustees meets at 7:30 p.m. in the Town Hall, 2240 West Ash Avenue in Decatur. The Long Creek Village Board of Trustees meets at 6:30 p.m. at 7135 East U.S. 36. The Moroa Public Library Board of Trustees meets at 6:30 p.m. Community Room in the Library, 305 East Garfield Street. The Mount Zion Village Board of Trustees meets at 5:15 p.m. in the Village Hall, 1400 Mount Zion Parkway. The Oakley Township Board of Trustees meets at 6 p.m., 221 Sangamon Street. South Wheatland Fire Protection District Board of Trustees meets at 7 p.m. in the training room at the Fire Station 1851 South Taylorville Road in Decatur. The Warrensburg Village Board of Trustees meets at 7 p.m. at 155 East Main Street. On Tuesday, the Harristown Township Board of Trustees meets at 7:30 p.m., 195 North Meridian Street. The Macon County Board of Health meets at 6:30 p.m. in the conference room of the Health Department, 1221 East Condit Street in Decatur. The Mount Zion Board of Education meets at 7 p.m., south wing of the Junior High School at 315 South Henderson Street. The Oriana Village Board of Trustees meets at 7 p.m., Whitmore Oriana Community Center, 407 South View Street. And finally, the Richland Community College Board of Trustees meets at 5:30 p.m. in room NS-121, National Sequestration Education Center. That's at 3451 President Howard Brown Boulevard in Decatur. This ends our first half hour of reading from the Decatur Herald and Review, October 16th, 2017. We'll take a short break and hope you will return for our second half hour reading. Thank you.